Thank you for both your comments. I'd like to open it up for questions, but before I do, I'd like to pose two for you myself, and then I'll let both of you answer as you will. The first one, when I think about classical Midrash, when I think about the Midrashim, I think about a collection of sacred texts that contain a whole bunch of fantastic narratives, right? But for the most part, I like to think about the Midrashim as exposing or illuminating absences in Torah, in the Hebrew Bible. And it's interesting to me to think about Midrashim as focused primarily on absence, especially in the context of reading Milton Steinberg's The Prophet's Wife, because it's called The Prophet's Wife. But once you read the novel, you see that it's not so much about the prophet's wife, it turns out. So the first thing I'd like you to address is why this is. What is Steinberg trying to do by drawing our attention to something that's actually absent in his narrative? And the second question has to do with, in Judaism, it's what you do that matters, right? It's not so much about intentionality. It's about action. It's not so much about what we intend to do. It's not so much about how we feel. It's about what we do. It doesn't necessarily matter what we're thinking about when we carry out Jewish ritual. It just matters that we do it, right? It's about deed versus creed. So I'm wondering if you see any indications of Steinberg attempting to suggest the significance of matters of the heart, the possibility that intentionality might matter more than we think it does. For instance, there's a part in the novel where he's disgusted with the two high priests as human beings, right? They're carrying out the Jewish rituals. They're enacting the things they're supposed to be enacting, but they're basically despicable human beings. And Steinberg draws our attention to this through the character of Hosea. There's another instance in the novel where the prophet Amos says, in response to, I think Hosea says something to the effect of, is there any hope for Israel? And Amos says, none, unless the people cease to do evil and learn to seek good. Now, I'm a literary scholar, first and foremost, so I see these little tiny word choices, and I like to make meaning out of them. So I'm wondering what you think about this word choice here. He doesn't attribute to the prophet Amos something to the effect of cease to do evil, learn to do good. He says cease to do evil, learn to seek good. And I wonder if you see anything purposeful behind that. So those are my two questions.
You know, in terms of the book's title, I mean, one question that I ask myself is, would in the second round or the third round or the fourth round, Gomer have a bigger role to play? He doesn't really go inside her mind at all. He doesn't go inside her heart. We don't understand the world through her eyes. Some have said that Steinberg is not so great about really fleshing out female characters altogether. But in my fantasy, I'd like to believe that he was planning to enter her mind more and that it was his intention to enter her mind and her heart. So I think that we have to do the Midrash, you know. We have to understand why he would call the book The Prophet's Wife and not really tell us about the prophet's wife. I mean, the same thing goes, by the way, with his mother, Ophrah, who kind of appears in the book, but we don't know a thing about her. She just kind of appears as a stick figure. Sometimes she's in the book, sometimes she's not in the book. Like, she just disappears from the book, sometimes she pops up again, but never does she have any impact on Hosea, except you'll see at one little scene where he yearns for her, but we don't know what their relationship is. She never teaches him. She never talks to him. She never has. We just see her bereft when her oldest is killed, but we don't know anything about her. So we have to do some guesswork. We have to do some, you know, jigsaw puzzle in our mind. But I guess another thing that when you're talking about intention and action, one of the things that really stuck out for me in this book is Hosea's helplessness, the character. He, first, I mean, he's obviously, he's depicted as the weak one, the one who sits and learns or has better literary understanding of things, but he's not, he has no muscles. But as a character, he has no courage to act. He just doesn't know how. Even when he catches his wife in bed with his brother, he doesn't know what to do. And he just can't seem to act it out and to do the deed or whatever it might be, whether it be vengeance or whatnot. And he finds himself constantly forgiving her and not, and he's angry with himself. I mean, he's angry with himself for having feelings of vengeance altogether. And again, I just started to think about, because I couldn't help myself, start thinking about Steinberg, the person, and what it might be like, just because I would never know what it might be like to be a rabbi. and having that, so many, maybe frustrations, maybe anger, maybe, you know, I spend a lot of time traveling around this country, speaking at different shuls. And I could see sort of the life of the rabbi from behind, because I might stay at the rabbi's house, and then see the life of the rabbi in front. And sometimes people tell me that rabbis are like stewardesses, like at shul, they spend a lot of time going, bye now, you know. But you know, that you might be carrying a lot of frustration, and it's your job to contain it, not to express it. And feelings of, God, you wish, you know, every once in a while you hear about a rabbi who punched out a congregant, but it's pretty rare, you know? Most of the time you spend your life containing frustration. And Milton Steinberg was, at the time of the writing of this book, a dying man. And he probably, and this is just my fantasies, I mean, he had a lot of frustration in his private life. And he certainly had a lot of frustration in his public life. And some of the things that he's working out here, I mean, we're reading the words of a person who understands that his heart is failing him. And we can see some of that even when he talks about his father. There's a scene where you see his father's difficulty breathing, his father's difficulty walking, his father covered in sweat. And you can understand a little bit about what he's living with and what he's living through. And this whole question of intention and action, and maybe his way of working out the problems of intention and action was to write, which is the way he expressed, the way he got out some of his frustration or made sense of his world, his community, his marriage, his God, his faith, was to write a fictional world where he could play this out. And to me, that's what I think is fascinating.
First, I want to thank Rabbi Levy for validating all the reasons why I left the pulpit a year ago.
How's your heart?
Great.
It's good now.
Feeling good. I think in terms of your first question, I really actually believe it goes back to what I, in my opinion, what I said earlier, that whereas it's midrashic, it's not midrash. So whereas midrash really seeks to do what you said, fill in those blanks, he's not seeking to do that here. He's not trying to recreate the midrash. So the prophet wife is, you know, again, I'm reading him as a novelist, the rabbi who was a creative novelist. A very catchy title, because, you know, much like it's a very catchy beginning to the book of Hosea, it intrigues you, as you know, it screams out at you in the first couple of verses that God is commanding this prophet to marry a prostitute. So you're like, oh, I want to keep reading. What's going to happen here? So, I mean, I think he was looking to really explore Hosea more than, you know, Hosea's wife. And I think it has a lot to do with a lot of what Rabbi Levy said. You know, he was looking to explore, you know, hear the voice of the rabbis in as a driven leaf now has become the voice of the prophets. You know, these different models of leaders, and a rabbi in a pulpit, in a community, in a congregation is is rabbi, is visionary, is prophet, is healer, is high priest, is head of ritual, is all those things. And much like back in the day, and you know, Steinberg's not the first to address the fact of corrupt priests. We find it in the Bible. The prophets address it. I mean, read Heschel's book, The Prophets, and there, that's his whole take on the prophets, is the fact that the prophets came as the counter to. I mean, when we read the Haftarot, you know, for example, the prophetic portion that's chosen the day of Yom Kippur, is, you know, unfortunately, most people, when you say the Haftarah of Yom Kippur, they think of the book of Jonah, because that's kind of like when they arrive to Shul. Yeah. For those who are there during Shacharit at 9:30, 10 o'clock, you read the Haftarah of the morning, the most powerful piece that we read for the day. When the prophet Isaiah says, "Is this the fast that I've chosen? Don't be hypocritical. How could you continue to oppress people and wear men put on sackcloth and ashes on your head and behave like you're pious and so on?" We know that the corruption of priests was rampant during the First Temple. During the Second Temple, it was one of the main reasons the rabbis gave for the downfall of the temple, was that corruption. So I think the fact that seek good versus, you know, do good was probably a term that he used, because as Jews were still searching for the meaning of good, because we can't seem to get it right. So, you know, do good, okay, how do you define that? I mean, do halakha, but the problem is, I mean, somebody told me a great story the other day, you know, halakha becomes sometimes, you know, a way of Jewish life sometimes becomes ultra mechanical. So, you know, there were rabbis throughout the Middle Ages that dealt with this problem, Chovot HaLevavot and Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. So there was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter wrote a whole section of writings that dealt with how to behave towards people, how to greet people. Pirkei Avot says, greet somebody with a smile, with a sever panim yafot. So they tell the story, I don't know if it's, you know, apocryphal, that, you know, after he died and his students put his writings together, and they wrote everything down into a manual and a code of conduct. And how did people behave? You know, in the same way that you have to drink a certain amount of wine to fulfill kiddush, or you have to eat a certain amount of matzah to fulfill Pesach, the al-achilat matzah. So you had situations where somebody greeted somebody else with a smile, and then they said, wait, let's try it again. Let me greet you again. And he said, why? He says, well, because I didn't smile enough to fulfill the halakha of what my rabbi said. So, you know, what does doing good mean? Sometimes we become so mechanical in our observance that it loses. So I think the fact that he used the term seek good, coming from the Hebrew, bakesh shalom v'radfehu, which comes from the book of Psalms, is the ultimate search in Jewish life for good. I think it probably also had to do with the fact that, you know, in a world that was, you know, turning upside down, the world during Steinberg's age, what's the definition of good? God, people around you, the community, America, what's good? Who's good anymore?
Other questions from the audience?